Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Coramdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about Bob's learnings from the Keller Center.
Yeah, we thought we'd take an episode. I spent time last month in New York City with the Keller Center Fellows. And so thought I'd download some of what I learned and help listeners maybe learn from and apply some of that. Yeah. More obviously, the work we're doing with the Keller Center is useless unless it gets into the bloodstream of the American church. And so I wanted to have an opportunity to talk about some of those things and help make them accessible for people. Just as a reminder, if you're a listener and you're newer to this idea, so you might know who Tim Keller is. He was a pastor, church planter in New York City, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, passed away last year. The Keller Center is a little think tank built kind of around his ministry and specifically the area of cultural apologetics, which I'll talk about in a minute. But there are 24 initial fellows who were asked to sort of do a three-year fellowship with this little center, this little think tank. And the goal of that is to create an opportunity for us to learn from one another and learn with one another and then create content that will serve the broader church in specifically in the area of apologetics. So it's sort of like the shorthand way to say it is like, think of what Tim Keller did really well. We want to kind of help the church do that as best we can. Take what he was really good at doing when it came to cultural analysis and sort of applying the gospel to post-Christianity, and how do we continue moving forward that work in ways that help churches and Christians do that better? So we get together once a year for a 3 or 4 day retreat in New York City. Retreat is not really
a New York City retreat.
Yeah, it's not like concrete retreat. Concrete retreat.
Let's call it more of like a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a workshop. You know, it's like we're working together on ideas, thoughts, learning. And then we go away from that and sort of there's projects that we're working on over the course of the rest of the year, writing, speaking, thinking, you know, creating, trying to build some resources to serve the broader church. Here's what I want to hear. This, the first thing I came away with that I was like, oh, I finally understand what this word means is I can finally define cultural apologetics for you.
Well, that's helpful.
Yeah, let's go.
Because I found a document that Keller had written where he had like typed out this little analogy. I was like, well, there. How come we never just said that? It's like it's buried in this document that Keller had built that I've never heard anyone at the Keller Center say. But I was like, oh, that is really helpful for me to get my mind around what this is. So here's Tim Keller's analogy using C.S. Lewis. There's two kinds of apologetics. There's rational or traditional apologetics and cultural apologetics. And what he says is rational apologetics is what C.S. Lewis is doing in Mere Christianity. And cultural apologetics is the Chronicles of Narnia. Mm. Cultural apologetics has more to do with story, imagination. How do we tell a better story that just gets into the bloodstream of the culture and sort of makes the Christian faith look beautiful because we're telling a good story. That's different work than sort of like, how do we counter arguments to the Christian faith? How do we answer skeptics and answer objections to the faith and stuff like that? That's more the rational apologetics. So another way that Keller used to talk about it is to say rational apologetics answers the question, is Christianity true? Cultural apologetics answers more, is it good and is it beautiful? Mm. So it's a little more in the category of imagination, narrative, storytelling. How do we continue to just hold forth the Christian gospel, not as just something true, but as something that's good for us and beautiful and the fulfillment of our deepest hopes and longings. So that was helpful to me. Yeah, yeah. I felt like, oh, mm-hmm. Now I can explain what cultural apologetics is when people are like, what does that mean?
That's helpful to me because you're with both of those analogies or both of those camps, you're pulling in the whole person.
Yeah.
Right? Like both the mind and the rational, like, hey, let's have a conversation over here. This one is like, let me pull you into this conversation and make it more beautiful.
Yeah. So people always ask me, I mean, I'm kind of doing this podcast for our own church. That's what we always say is we're sort of primarily speaking to the people of our churches. But people ask me, hey, so what do you guys do when you get together? You know, like, what do you guys work on? And the answer is, one, some of the gathering is actually just about creating a set of relationships that are sticky. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is, think about how disembodied the world we live in is, and how online and disconnected our relationships are. So part of the point of going to New York for 4 days together is just like eating meals together, taking the subway together, going to a baseball game together, you know, rooming together, like just talking, the amount of face-to-face connectedness that allows you to build meaningful trust. And that actually just leads to really fun conversations, mm-hmm. where you're just sort of workshopping things or talking about ideas or thinking together about a problem. The people who are the fellows are just some of the best thinkers and writers that are working today in Christianity. And so it's just, when you get those people in a room, it's not like we're talking about, you know, the weather. We're talking about really intense cultural topics and questions and, you know, things going on in our actual lives and churches where we're facing, here's questions people are asking, or here's a new issue that's cropping up that we need to answer better. Or here's places where it feels like the gospel isn't satisfying to people in ways that it should be. So that's a lot of what we do is just like, we're creating face-to-face interaction. And I just value every, this is the second year we've done this gathering in New York. And every time I come away and go like, yeah, there's no way you can kind of replicate that. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do that on Zoom. You couldn't do it with a bunch of emails. There's something about being together that builds camaraderie, trust, fellowship, and kind of a dense learning.
Yeah. And it sounds that will, the stuff you're working on then is just going to be all the richer because of those relationships.
Exactly. The other thing we did is we spend a lot of time learning. So like both bringing in outside speakers and saying, hey, let's have this person sort of like do some work with us on a topic. And also like letting some of the fellows engage with one another. So you guys know who Chris Watkin is, Australian, really brilliant, wrote the book Biblical Critical Theory. He, after Tim Keller died last year, started listening chronologically to every Tim Keller sermon ever preached. And so in the last 9 months, he said, I've listened to every Keller sermon from 1989 to 1999. So he's like, I still got the 21st century to go, but on 20th century Keller, I'm your man. I know everything, you know? So basically what he did is he did a whole lecture for us where he just sort of said, here's what I see Tim doing as a preacher as I listen to just hundreds of his sermons, which was actually really interesting. Because you think about, like, we all appreciated learning from, there's something about Keller's preaching that has benefited many people. But it was more like trying to get inside his workshop and say, here's what I see him doing in how he preaches. And that's what Chris did for us, was just sort of lay out what he learned from that. We spent 2 hours with Ross Douthat, the New York Times columnist, just asking questions about culture primarily and just saying, hey, what do you see happening in the culture? Tell us about the work you're trying to do as sort of a cultural apologist. You know, Ross is a conservative Catholic who writes for the New York Times. So he was joking about the fact that, like, you know, the New York Times is not the most conservative publication. And so he, you know, he's in an interesting environment because I realize I'm writing for people who mostly disagree with everything I say, you know, so how do you carry yourself in that kind of an environment? How do you write and make a credible case for Christianity in a very hostile and skeptical environment? So that was really fun. We brought in Ryan Burge, who's a sociologist and had done some work on dechurching. So there was a lot of opportunities just to learn and sort of digest together some content, some wrestling with some questions, and just sort of like engaging some topics. And there was a couple things that were interesting takeaways that I felt like, oh, these are things that I think I'm going to go away and sort of think about. And I think actually for the listeners of this podcast, there's some trends, some things that we identified that I feel like, oh, that's interesting. I'm not sure what that's going to mean, but it means something. It's kind of those things you walk away like, I'm not sure what to do with that, but there's something there. The first thing was, you know, Ryan Burge he teaches at Eastern Illinois University. He has a Substack that's just a ton of charts. He builds charts. He's a very visual thinker. So it's cool because he's taking data and kind of making it, you know, memorable with charts. But one of the things he pointed out in the data is that right now, if you think about Gen Z, so what is that, 20, 27 or 28 and younger, you know, it's like all my kids' generation, basically. For the first time ever, young men are more religious than young women. He said this is the first time we've seen this shift, and you see it in the last 10 years, suddenly there's an uptick in the number of young men who are religious and in the number of young men who are conservative. So one of the things that sociologists are paying attention to right now is younger women are tending more liberal. Mm-hmm. They're moving to the left. Younger men are moving to the right. And a lot of people are seeing this as like an interesting divergence where it's like, if the trends continue, it seems like they're going to be on different pages. Like, you know, women are going to be to the left and men are going to be to the right. And they see that politically, culturally, socially. So that was an interesting, you know, it's interesting to me anytime we see an uptick in young men toward both religiosity and toward like a more conservative posture toward family or toward marriage or toward culture. If you just ask like, do you want to get married? More young men say yes. More young women say no. So that's an interesting, I'm not sure what to do with that data, but I just walked away going, that's going to mean something for the future of the church.
Yeah. Is there any, does Burge have any thoughts on the causes of that? Those shifts?
He has some thoughts, but that's where you're like, it's not data driven. You know, it's interpretation at this point. Sure, you know, but he, you know, Burge's hypothesis that I'm not sure it's true. In fact, there were people in the room who disagreed vehemently with him, but his hypothesis is that maybe the Dobbs decision has something to do with that. In the sense that like women see that as a bellwether for like, hey, if the cult, you know, if the culture is making abortion illegal, I'm tilting to the left. I don't know that that's I don't know that that explains anything. And he was not making that reasoning from data. It was just sort of like a, here's what I think it might be.
Yeah.
So I don't want to, you know, I don't know that that's verifiable or not verifiable, but there could be tons of reasons for that, you know?
Yeah. It's a fascinating reality. Cause I mean, for how many decades have we heard, you know, the church, men are leaving the church,
right.
The church doesn't, it's too feminized, this, that, or the other. What, there had to potentially be some sort of shift where men are feeling more comfortable in the church in some ways. So even that's curious.
Yeah, it's very interesting. The second interesting data point I came away with is the rise in the demonic and new age spirituality and occult practices among college students. A couple of our fellows are campus ministry people, and Ross Douthat made this. He had written a column at some point about like AI and demons, that like connecting those two things of like, hey, artificial intelligence is cool, but what if we're actually dealing with something bigger than just
digital data? Ouija boards,
right? And so Douthat had like, I don't know, someone had read that he had talked about that, and these campus ministry people were like, yep, that's absolutely the case among young students. Like there's a flourishing of interest in like new age spirituality, the occult. There's these TikTok accounts like that's called Witch Talk. That's the hashtag that's like conjuring and manifestations and all this sort of like occultish stuff that's not driven by like, I believe in the occult, but it's almost like I want to explore spiritually things that aren't really tied to an established religion. And it's surprising to me to hear people say like, oh yeah, that's really prominent among college students right now. Because I'm more of like I assume secularism is on the rise, you know, and everybody's kind of deconstructing, but they're like, nope, that's definitely not the case. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of interest in spirituality and in the transcendent, but just not tied to an orthodoxy.
Sure, sure. I've heard that that has been the case in Europe for a while too, that the secularism has given way to kind of the rise of neo-paganism.
Yep.
So kind of maybe seeing that trend.
Yeah, there's a lot of, yeah. And I think that neo-paganism is probably the right word for it. It's just like a big category that includes everything from like crystals and you know, new agey stuff to, you know, earth worship and pantheism and all, you know, the immanentizing of people are still looking for some mystery or mystical experience. It's just like in the world rather than beyond, you know, beyond the creation. So that was fascinating. I was like, I need to think about that. You know, that probably has some implications even for how we preach and how we think about engaging that generation of people.
That makes sense, because even in the last couple of years around here, some people who have recently been around Coram Deo have had some of those stories.
Yeah, that's a lot more. And then, you know, it's connected to things like social media, because obviously there's anything that's a trend on social media. It's like that when everybody's, I don't know, this is like 8 years ago, but kids got into Tide Pods as like a way of getting high. And it was like, it became a TikTok rage or a social media rage for like 3 months. Everybody's worried about it. You know, it's the same kind of thing where there's like a knock-on effect where it's like, it's popular on social media. So that makes me want to try it. There's some of that happening, but it's also connected to like the rise of psychedelics, mushrooms and LSD and like, you know, people that are into like quote unquote self-actualization or fitness or like, you know, higher consciousness and drugs are the way to access that. And so there's a whole subculture there. So it's kind of the 60s all over again, you know, in certain ways. But I think that's interesting for the church and interesting. It made me realize as I think about the work of apologetics, we're not just dealing with like rising secularism. We're actually dealing with a different kind of enchantment. Mm-hmm. And an enchantment that's not seeking the transcendent in God, but that's seeking transcendent experiences within the world. And opening up to maybe some deeper kinds of spiritual oppression. So that was an interesting learning. And then the third thing that was interesting to me that Ross Douthat mentioned is the fracturing of the left, which you're seeing that in all the college campuses right now.
Yeah.
You know, he says the left, and this is, you know, Ross Douthat is he's in that world. He's a New York City resident. He writes at the Times. Most of his friends are connected to sort of more progressive and liberal causes. And he says on the political left, there's a huge split between the liberals and the progressives, you know, or what he would call like the Marxists and the classical liberals. You know, you have some people that are all in on the woke stuff and it's like, you can't be woke enough. And then you have classical liberals who see the way that is destroying institutions and they are distancing themselves from that. And he says, it's not clear what's going to become of that fracture yet, but that fracturing on the left is a very real thing. And he thinks it's going to have consequences this election year, but also just beyond in our society, it's going to be interesting to see what happens to the sort of more woke left and the more classically liberal progressive left. That's like, you know, I want gay marriage and I want liberalism and I want, you know, open borders, but I don't want, you know, people burning down the college campuses and, you know, that kind of thing. So, it is interesting to think about the same fragmenting we've kind of seen on the right, where you have the Trumpy people and then the sort of more classically neoconservative people. You see the same thing on the political left as well. And it'll be interesting to see what becomes of that. But as he was describing that, again, it made me realize, oh, you know, we're in a moment as we think about preaching and communicating the gospel where there are multiple sub-tribes, you know. It's not just, are you left or right? You know, it's like there's actually multiple subcategories of each.
Yeah. So in light of all the kind of those things that were particularly interesting, I guess the question I'm super curious about is what kinds of things are the fellows working on? And in particular, what are you working on?
Well, so there are a few things the fellows are working on. And then me particularly, I'm caught up in a couple. I have aspects of these projects connected to me, but the one thing we're sort of all giving ourselves to is Tim Keller, before he died, had framed out what he called seven cultural narratives. So he's trying to get at what are the stories our culture tells that answer the questions of who am I, why am I here, where are we going, what's going to make life better, et cetera. There's like these six or seven questions that everybody's asking. And so he had framed out these seven cultural narratives as things like freedom, progress, you know, morality. There's like, what stories is our culture telling in these areas? And Tim's son has these all in a doc. He's like, I went through my dad's computer and, you know, there's like 46,000 words he'd written on these cultural narratives. So part of what we're trying to do is gather that and do some work to frame out what are those narratives and how can we equip the church to sort of counteract those narratives? Because they're, you know, when we say narratives, you know, it's like the thing that's in every Disney princess movie, you know, where it's like self-actualization, be yourself, be the best version of you. You can be anything you, it's that kind of thing where it's like no one's getting up and preaching a sermon, but those narratives are baked into art and they're baked into music and they're baked into culture. And so we just imbibe them without really thinking about it. And part of what we want to do is make explicit, hey, here's the cultural narrative, and here's where it falls short. Here's where it doesn't satisfy. And so in a sense, just trying to do some work around making those cultural narratives explicit and helping the church be able to name them and talk about them and see how the gospel's different from them, see how they're in a sense counterfeit gospels. So that work is stuff that Keller had begun working on but hadn't been finished yet, and that I think over the next couple of years, the fellows at the Keller Center will do some work around those things, and you'll start seeing some things come out. We're working on like a catechism for kids built around that stuff, working on some videos and podcast projects built around those things, and hopefully maybe even a book that sort of frames those out. But it's, you know, in a sense, it's like super baseline cultural stuff that Keller was always really good at. But what he did well was condensing it down in packages that made sense to people. You know, it's like, here's the seven. I'm sure there's more than seven. You know, there's probably 100 cultural narratives, but here's seven that you hear all the time that are just really foundational to how we think about the world. So that's one of the major projects that various fellows are working on. And then all of us just kind of, you know, part of what we did at the retreat in New York was we spent 3 hours just sort of working on those narratives. Like, hey, here's the seven. How do you see them expressed in culture? Where would you push back? Is this the right thing to call them, or is there a better thing to call? You know, just sort of like hashing through the raw material of that and asking, how can we talk about this in ways that would resonate with the average person in the church or the average listener to a podcast? So I'm excited about that work. I think it will be fruitful. That's not the only thing that fellows are working on. I mean, obviously, you think about who all the fellows are and all the projects they have going anyway. You know, there's a lot of people who are writing books and working on a podcast or a video or a apologetics. You know, Gavin Ortland's running a whole YouTube channel doing basically apologetics on everything from, you know, war in the Old Testament to should I be a Protestant or should I be a Catholic to, you know. So there's a ton of people doing really beautiful work. And part of what I'm trying to do is just like, man, let me put wind in their sails however I can. And I think my role particularly is to try to bring that into the local church. How do I think as a pastor? Because a lot of these people are more academics and writers and thinkers. You know, they have a more broad public-facing ministry. Part of what I do is say, hey, how would this look in a church? What can we put to work in churches that could help the average person? And part of what I think we need to do is, the way I'm thinking is, how do we inoculate our kids against those cultural narratives?
Yeah.
You know, those...
Before it hits.
Right. I mean, think about the narrative of identity. You know, you get to choose your own identity. Identity is whatever you decide to be. How do we help kids at an early age be able to spot that narrative and see like, oh, that's the story that's being told. And then how does the Bible contradict that narrative or counteract that narrative? So that we're teaching them to not just imbibe everything culture is telling them and then add Jesus, you know, but to be, it's the work of deconstruction or the work of unmasking, right? How do we do like what Revelation does where it's like, hey, let's see the symbolic stories our culture is telling us. And let's learn to be attentive to them and to critique them with the gospel.
So going back to Michael Keller and his, you know, his dad's computer, is it as simple as like, hey, here's all this stuff my dad has typed up, cursors right here. Guys, check this out. We got to keep writing.
No. Because, you know, like the brilliance of Tim Keller, he gets ideas down, but they're like little talks he did here and there or, you know, things he was writing out and thinking out, but none of it's like systematized. And so I'm sure there's lots of good raw material there, but someone like Michael will have to take it and sort of organize it and put it together, you know? The other thing that I think is really interesting is, you know, we've got James Eglinton, Grace Utanto, Dan Strange. All those guys are sort of Herman Bavinck and Johann Bavinck experts, you know, so the neo-Calvinist strain of apologetics, which is like leans into common grace and also antithesis, you know? So it's like, there's a lot of common ground we have with non-Christians, and also the gospel confronts, you know, our attempts to evade Christ. And so I think there's more work to be done there of how do we continue to appropriate that? Now those guys are kind of doing their own, they're releasing a new Bavinck book every 2 months. You know, it's just like, they're just translating Bavinck and putting Bavinck stuff out. But I think there's more to do there to sort of continue to take not just the philosophical resources that are there, but to do some of the translation work into how can that help us do better apologetics? How can that help us find places of common ground, ways to connect with culture? In fact, the next podcast we do, I'm going to show you one of Dan Strange's tools for how to take some of that stuff that Bavinck did at a more conceptual level and kind of make it accessible and practical for talking with your neighbor about the gospel. So I think there's work that we'll continue to do that's kind of leveraging academic stuff that people are doing and appropriating it more faithfully for the church and for the average Christian who's not going to read a book on French post-structuralism, but, you know, might be interested in a tool that helps them talk to their neighbor.
Yeah.
Bob, what's it like for you in that room? Like, what kind of energy do you get? What kind of challenge do you get? What's that doing to your development right now?
It's a fun room to be in because I love people who like to think, and, you know, there's some great thinkers in that room. And, man, just humble people, like just godly people. I'm just around some of these people. I'm like, I need to get sanctified. Like, I need to be more like Jesus because these people are like more like Jesus, you know? And that's a beautiful thing.
That's cool.
But I just, it's refreshing. You know, it's joyful. It's also a great room because going back to our podcast last week on competence, it's a room of people who are pretty competent at what they do and have a pretty grounded identity.
Yeah.
And so you can fight a little bit. You can disagree. Like, no one's offended when you're like, hey, I'm not sure I agree with you on that. They're not like, oh, you're crushing my, you know, it's just that's, so we have a lot of back and forth, a lot of point counterpoint. There are moments when someone will raise their hand and just be like, hang on, I'm not with you on that. Like, just like start an argument across the room in a friendly way. So it's really sharpening in the sense that it doesn't feel like we're just there to pat each other in the back and say, whatever you do is great. You know, it's like, hey, let's think that out together. Let me push back on that. I'm not sure I buy that, you know? And, that's really fun for me. It's fun to be in a room where it feels like nobody's live tweeting this conversation. Like, it's a safe room to just like work out ideas where we're not trying to produce anything yet. We're just thinking about stuff. Mm-hmm. And also it's a safe room to like push back, disagree, learn from one another. I say to the fellows all the time, because I'm the guy that's just like a little bit contrarian in the room. Like, sometimes I'll just raise my hand and be like,
imagine that, Dusty.
I disagree. That.
Really? Really?
I mean, wow.
And what's great is I say to them, like, hey guys, this is how I learn. Like, when I push back, it's not because I actually disagree. It's because I disagree right now. And like, the next thing you say might convince me, like, oh, my disagreement is stupid, you know? So being able to be in a room where I can just do that and where there's some freedom to learn that way is really refreshing.
And there's nothing at stake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And every one of these people loves Jesus, loves the church, wants to see the gospel advance and cares about the human beings who are being affected by all these false narratives. And so there's a real deep consciousness of the work we're doing is important, but the work we're doing is ultimately about the human beings that are going to be served by it, you know?
Yeah. That's encouraging to hear, because typically when you're dealing with academics, it's a lot of ego. Don't challenge me. You know, it's like, this is my thing and my sacred cow sort of thing. So
yeah, zero of the fellows are like that. Yeah, it's wild,
that's,
man.
That's awesome that there's a genuine godliness and humility and sense of, hey, we're for each other and let's help each other be better for the good of the church. So
yeah,
that's encouraging.
Yeah. It's really a beautiful room to be in, and I'm honored to be there and thankful for the work that, so many of those people are just doing really, really wonderful work for the sake of the church that I benefit from and learn from and appreciate. So
are you the only pastor?
No, there's a few of us. There's Jeremy Treat, Andrew Wilson.
Okay.
You know, there's others. I'm trying to think, Vermone, Pierre. So there's a bunch of us. There's a handful of us that are pastoring in a local church. And then there's others like Sam Alberry and Gavin who are on church staffs who might not be a lead pastor, but they're on a team, you know? Yeah. So there's a handful of, and everybody is like vitally connected to their local church. Like there's zero people who are like just Christians on Twitter, but don't actually, that's one of the best things. Everybody's grounded in a local church, you know? So it's just like, you know, we're all actually discipling people.
And they're probably in churches where the people are not impressed with their status. Exactly. They're like, you're just Sam. Well, I mean, he's a pastor, but just so-and-so in the church, and that's good for them. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really great.
That is good, because we do live in a day and age where you can be a Christian on Twitter.
There's a lot of those people.
But not in real life.
And that's one of the things I appreciate about the Gospel Coalition is it's church-centric. You know, it cares about the flourishing of the local church. And each of these fellows, man, they're doing the work they do because they want to see the church thrive. So it's a joy to be part of something that's very, very intellectual, but very church-grounded.
Well, it's good. I'm glad that you're doing it. I'm glad you're in that room. There's still some time will tell what will come of it.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you're being challenged, and I'm glad you're bringing it back to at least our two churches by proxy for City, I guess, you know, and we'll benefit from you just being there.
Well, and I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where there's that old proverb, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats. Like part of what I think is just like, even when I don't bring back tangible things, the work that we're doing at the Keller Center hopefully just raises the tide of the American church in our ability to talk about things meaningfully. You know, when you have Gavin Ortland doing YouTube videos on slavery in the Bible, that's, you know, when someone asks me as a pastor, like, hey, where can I learn about like how to talk to somebody about genocide in the Old Testament? I'd be like, go watch Gavin's video on that. You know, so it's, I'm just saying like there's ways that actually just the work we're doing together at the Keller Center, I think just sort of helps the church have more resources. You know, even Rebecca McLaughlin's book that just came out recently about, you know, 10 arguments against same-sex relationships or partnerships. Just those are tools we need. You know, the church needs good answers to some of these questions. And so there's a way that I think the work there just sort of helps the church have more competence in some of the conversations that we're all finding ourselves in, whether it's in a formal church setting or whether it's with a family member or a neighbor across the street.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners, so if you have thoughts, questions, future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.